From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. As NASA's first flight director, Chris Kraft sat in the other hot seat. He made the final decision whether to launch or to abort a flight. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Chris Kraft. He directed all the Mercury missions, some of the Gemini missions, and was director of flight operations through most of the Apollo program. He has a new memoir. Also, humanitarian aid worker Kenneth Gluck. He was recently freed after being kidnapped in Chechnya and held captive for 26 days. He's still not sure who his captors were or why they let him go. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Doctors in Washington say Vice President Dick Cheney underwent a procedure today to reopen one of the arteries in his heart. The vice president checked himself into the George Washington University Hospital today after experiencing what were described as two brief episodes of chest pain. Dr. Jonathan Reiner was part of the team that performed the procedure.
When patients re-narrow their coronary arteries, they redevelop chest pain. And, you know, with the characteristic nature of his chest pain and the two episodes today, you know, we thought that it was prudent to just proceed with angiography.
Reiner said there was no sign that Cheney had suffered another heart attack. Cheney, who's 60, had his most recent heart attack in November. Police in Southern California have arrested a 15-year-old boy accused of killing two classmates in a shooting at his high school. From member station KPBS, Nancy Greenlease reports that 14 other people were wounded.
All suffered injuries when a freshman, characterized as a loner, opened fire at Santana High School in Santee, a blue-collar city near San Diego. At least five people are being treated for superficial gun wounds, among them a 24-year-old security guard. The unarmed guard was shot five times. He'd gone into the school bathroom to stop the assailant. Outside Scripps Mercy Hospital in San Diego, his uncle called the shooting upsetting, saying it's ridiculous that children have access to guns. Classes are canceled Tuesday at Santana High School. Counseling will be available when it reopens. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Greenlease in San Diego.
School officials say the wounded included a school supervisor. Israel has heightened security amid warnings of more suicide bomb attacks. After 5 months of conflict with Palestinians, attacks inside Israel have been increasing. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
The army deployed more heavily along the border with the West Bank. In cities, police volunteers were drafted and working shifts extended. City buses, a main target for bombers, were heavily scrutinized. At Jerusalem's main station, security officers brought in an X-ray machine to screen luggage. Much of this conflict has hardly touched Israelis. Clashes have been contained in the West Bank and Gaza. Casualties have been overwhelmingly Palestinian. But a series of recent bomb attacks has produced a mounting sense of national nervousness. Politicians and newspaper editorials appeal to the public not to surrender to fear. Prime Minister-elect Ariel Sharon, expected to assume office Wednesday, has vowed to restore security. But security officials are urging Israelis to brace for an extended state of alert. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Jerusalem.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 96 points to close at 10,562. Advances led declines by a small margin in moderate trading. This is NPR News. California Governor Gray Davis says the state has reached long-term agreements with power suppliers that will keep electricity flowing for the next 10 years. Davis said 40 contracts and other deals will allow the state to buy power for much less than it's been paying on the spot market. The Mormon Church is changing its unofficial name. NPR's Howard Berkus reports from Salt Lake City.
The official name has been The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints for 160 years. But Mormon Church was used as shorthand first by critics and later by church members and even church officials. The shorthand comes from the Book of Mormon, which provides the doctrinal basis for the religion. Some Christian denominations consider the church a cult, arguing its beliefs in modern prophecy, godhood, and sainthood place it outside the Christian mainstream. Mormon leaders are trying to emphasize their Christian tenets and want members and reporters to avoid the common shorthand. A news release notes the move is significant because of the attention the church expects to receive during next year's Winter Olympics here in Salt Lake City. Church of Jesus Christ is suggested as a substitute, even though that name already belongs to another group. Howard Berkus, NPR News, Salt Lake City.
Macedonian officials say they've mobilized police and army units to fight guerrillas operating along the mountainous border with Kosovo. The defense ministry said it took action after two Macedonian soldiers were killed by a landmine in the area yesterday. A spokesman said the guerrillas attacked the soldiers at a point about 4 miles inside the Macedonian border. On the Kosovar side, U.S. peacekeeping forces sent armored vehicles to patrol the border area. Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo Marriott Services, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services in healthcare, education, and corporations. SodexoMarriott.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. When the Soviets launched Sputnik into orbit in 1957, NASA didn't exist, and Chris Kraft was an engineer testing military aircraft. He had no expertise in rocketry or even basic astronomy. Nonetheless, Chris Kraft was tapped as a member of the original Space Task Group in charge of NASA's first major program, the Mercury missions. Kraft directed the first rocket launches, created mission control in Cape Canaveral, and was the flight director for all the Mercury missions, some of the Gemini missions, and director of flight operations through most of the Apollo program. Besides the astronauts, Kraft was one of NASA's better-known personalities at the heyday of the space program. He was the man in headphones at Mission Control, the last stop in the chain of command that either gave the go-ahead to launch or to abort a flight. Kraft has a new memoir, Flight: My Life in Mission Control. In it, he writes that early on in the space program, one of the most basic tasks he faced turned out to be one of the most challenging. He had to build a countdown to liftoff.
Well, when you think about it, the number of pieces of equipment in a missile range, for instance, the cameras, the telemetry system, the communication system, all of the support activities, and then you add to that the rocket, the spacecraft, preparing the human being to get ready to go, the various remote sites across the world that had to be involved. And so if you're going to bring all this thing to T-zero and make sure that everything is working to the best of your ability at that particular moment, now to ensure that that's going to take place, you want to make sure that everybody runs a test, everybody says what I've got is working and it's doing well and I'm ready to go. When you stop to think about that, there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of pieces of this thing that have to do something to say, yes, I'm ready to go at a certain time. So when you start building these programs, these tests, and that's what we eventually call a countdown, for each one of these pieces of equipment, for each one of these areas, for the launch pad, for the spacecraft, for the guys that are getting the astronaut ready, when do they have to start? When do you have to run this test? How much training do you have to do, et cetera? That's what makes a countdown so extremely complicated. It just a single countdown for a given piece of equipment, like a camera, that's a long-range camera looking at the rocket being launched. The guy goes through these tests. Does the camera run? Is the power there? Will it take a picture? And if it does, can I see through the clouds, et cetera? But now expand that by a factor of 1,000, if you will. And everybody's writing a countdown for each one of those things. Now you can see how complex that gets to be.
In the process of designing the first Mercury mission, 7 men were chosen from a pool of active duty military test pilots to be the astronauts. I don't believe there was the term astronaut yet. When John Glenn was one of the active duty military test pilots chosen to be an astronaut, you already knew him. You had a few
run-ins with him when he was then a Marine major, and you were working at Langley testing airplanes. What was your beef with him?
When you're the lead pilot, which he was in the Navy Bureau of Aeronautics for a particular high-performance airplane, in this case the F-8U, which was one of the Navy's first supersonic fighters, it's your baby. And so you don't think it's much wrong with it, and you don't like to hear people saying there's something wrong with it. That was his job. My job was to run the flying qualities of that airplane, and if it had something wrong with it, point that out to the Navy so they could make it a better airplane. That was our job. I found a lot of things wrong with it that their test pilots, who were company test pilots, knew about but weren't making any issue of. I was making an issue of them because I wanted to make the airplane better and safer to fly. And so I had a lot of convincing to do every time I told them that their airplane wasn't as good and perfect as they thought it was.
You refer to his, I believe it's the word is gyrene stubbornness?
Yes.
I had to look that one up.
You know, pilots have a tough time dealing with flight test engineers anyway. If you read Yeager's book, he said those damn guys at NACA talked a language I didn't even understand. But very true. When I told him that the PB over 2V of his airplane was 0.07 and it should be 0.08, he didn't know what the hell I was talking about. And I understand that. That's fine. But it was a way for me to describe the fact that the airplane didn't roll fast enough. It wasn't that. It was just that we were at odds back in those days when he was doing that task. So I knew him before he got to be what eventually was called an astronaut. So we had that background with each other. I think he eventually had a lot of respect for me, and I had a lot of respect for him.
Now, May 5th, 1961 was the first Mercury mission, and there's a wonderful photo in the book of Alan Shepard in his spacesuit looking up at the Freedom 7 rocket before he boarded. The story that everyone remembers about that first mission is that Shepard's biggest problem, at least on the launch pad, was his bladder.
Yes.
He was in the capsule for 4 hours, and he needed to go. And I assume he told you that you were in on this conversation in flight control, right? That he couldn't, you would not permit him out. That just wasn't possible. Had you
That's
anticipated
correct.
This issue, the need to go?
Yes, we had anticipated it, but we hadn't done anything about it. We had been working on a urine collection device, UCD we called it, but we didn't have it perfected for that flight. We also didn't expect him to be in the spacecraft for as long as he had to be before we launched. We got into problems with the weather. We got in problems with the spacecraft. We got a number of problems with the rocket. So that by the time we got around to getting ready to start the final part of the countdown, he'd been in there a long time. And as you well know, when the adrenaline is flowing, and it was flowing that morning, then you have to pee. and so he had to, he said, I've got to urinate. And he said, can I get out? Because we were in a hold. And now that would have really buggered things up because we'd have had to open the spacecraft, had to get him out of there and let him go and then get him back in. So we'd have had to restart the countdown at something like T-minus 2.5 hours. So rather than do that, we said, go in your pants. And he did. And the flow of oxygen dried it up pretty quickly. The next flight, we did have our UCD for Gus Grissom. It was something that you could attach to the penis and pee.
You write in your book that at the start of the countdown for that first mission, you were shaking so hard you couldn't see your microphone. And it made me think of something Gene Kranz, a later flight director, once said, that he described launch as an existential moment. It's like combat. What are those seconds like for you?
This was the first time that we had a man on the end of a rocket. Nobody had ever done that before. Mr. Shepherd's, and you said when we started the countdown, it wasn't there. You never got serious about any countdown until you, at that time, until you got to T-minus 2 minutes. That's when you knew, when you went past that point, you damn well better get ready to launch. But it, now, at that time, Shepherd's heart rate was about 220. I don't know what mine was, but later flights said mine was about 180. If you don't realize that this is dangerous, that something bad can happen a lot of the time, and that this is the first time that a man is going to be the end of a damn rocket, and you're not shaken, you damn well don't understand the problem.
Now, in the second manned flight, Gus Grissom was the astronaut, and everything went off pretty much fine except for the splash landing. Somehow the hatch blew off prematurely. The capsule sank, and Grissom had a tough time of it staying afloat. NASA never really did find out what exactly happened, and there have been two camps. Some thought Grissom panicked and hit the hatch detonator, and others thought that it was some unknown malfunction. After all the investigations into this, what did you think went wrong?
I believe Gus. When Gus said, "I didn't hit the button, that damn thing blew off by itself, and the first thing I saw was water coming over the sill," I said, "That is 100% correct."
You thought that then, and you think this now?
I thought that then, and I think it 10 years, 20 years, and I will always think that. Gus was a superb test pilot, maybe one of the best, if not the best. And there was no question in my mind he told us what happened. I think a lot of people couldn't figure out how in the world that could happen because when, in all the tests we ran after that, we couldn't make it happen. We shook the thing, we hit on it, we did everything we could, and we couldn't make it go off inadvertently. But Gus said it went that way, and I believed him. I still believe him.
Chris Kraft was NASA's first flight director. He directed the first manned missions into orbit and oversaw the Apollo mission to the moon. His new memoir is Flight, My Life in Mission Control. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is NASA's first flight director, Chris Kraft. He helped develop NASA's space program from its earliest days. His new memoir is Flight, My Life in Mission Control. I'd like to back up a little bit to back to 1962, to John Glenn's first flight. There was a problem with his flight. There was a question whether the heat shield was loose or not. And if it was loose, the capsule would ignite on reentry. Could you describe the scene in Mission Control and what your options were for that flight?
Yes. When the spacecraft flew over the Cape on the second time, there was a telemetry signal, radio signal coming down from the spacecraft that said the spacecraft heat shield was loose. And that came from a measurement of a small switch which moved when the heat shield actually loosened up and then dropped free down about 3 or 4 feet, and there was a bag there which would acted as a impact alleviation device when it hit the water. I heard that problem as it was presented to me. He said, "We see this signal." And I said, "Well, we haven't had any noises. Glenn hasn't reported anything from the spacecraft. He hadn't heard any noises of the space of the heat shield being loose. We haven't had any problems controlling the spacecraft in terms of anything bouncing around. It's got to be a false signal."
So you had a gut sense that this
I had a was I was a absolutely convinced in my mind that it was a false signal. And that's not unusual in a instrumented system. Many times the thing you're trying to use to measure it fails. Not unusual in any, as an engineer, common occurrence. So I thought to myself, and I confirmed that by talking to my other engineers, and I talked to Alan Shepard about it, as a matter of fact. And we all concluded that that's erroneous. Now, in comes the chief designer, and in comes my boss, and he's listening to the two chief designers, one from McDonnell, one from NASA. And they're saying, well, we think it probably is wrong also, but what if it isn't? And so I listened to those arguments, and they said, well, if we keep the RetroPack on, the straps that hold the RetroPack will maybe hold the heat shield up tight against the spacecraft, at least until it gets into the sensible atmosphere, and then the atmosphere will keep it there. That might be a better chance and a better thing to do in case, in the 0.1% case, that it might be right. So I listened to those arguments, and I said, I don't think so. Then my boss said to me, but I think that it's still a good thing to do, so do it. I didn't like that direction, but he was my boss at the time, and we left it on. That was a damn bad thing to do, because the reason I didn't want to do it is because you could have gotten a Mach cone coming off of that that RetroPack that was still there and burn a hole in the heat shield. And that was what worried the hell out of me, because we'd had something like that happen before. So after that was all over, I'll tell you what I said. I know a hell of a lot more about this thing than they know. I've got a lot better engineers telling me what's going on than they have. And the next time they tell me to do something, they better think twice about it, because I ain't going to do it unless I'm convinced it's the right thing to do.
When you first heard of President Jack Kennedy's goal of landing a man on the moon, was the moon your first choice, or did you have other ideas?
I didn't have any ideas at the moment, because I was so embroiled in putting a man in orbit around the Earth for the United States for the first time that what the next project was, or where the new goals were going to be, was beyond my pay grade. It was my responsibility to get that thing done and done well and bring the astronaut back safely and then measure what we had done. So when Mr. Kennedy said, we choose to go to the moon in this decade, frankly, it was beyond my comprehension. I didn't know what we had to do that. And the magnitude of doing that was so great, I had no idea how big that job was. I just knew that it was something that was totally beyond my ability to cope with the problems that might come up as a result of that. And I was proven right, too, because the problems almost became infinite to do that job compared to flying a man in orbit around the Earth three times and recovering in the ocean.
Now, a month before the first Apollo mission, during a checkout flight, a fire broke out in the spacecraft at Cape Canaveral that was manned by Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee. You were in mission control in Houston.
Yes.
What was your experience in Houston during that crisis?
Well, I was sick in the stomach. I was about as stunned as I've ever been in my life before or since. It took 2 or 3 minutes to realize that you just killed three men.
When did you first know something had gone wrong? What did you hear in your headphones, or what alerted you?
I heard some screaming. I heard some confused people in the on the launch pad out, external to the spacecraft. I heard a voice with which I was very familiar say, "We're on fire." And I heard another voice which I was very familiar with saying, "Get me out of here." And then I heard silence. And then I heard people scurrying about. And I was afraid to ask. And when I did ask, I got the answer I wasn't that I knew I was going to get and didn't ever want to hear.
Was there anything that could have been done to get the astronauts out?
In that spacecraft, it took, at a minimum, 2-3 minutes for an astronaut to turn around in his seat, crank a crank, which opened the hatch, and by that time, under these circumstances, where they were probably dead within a few seconds, there was nothing anybody could do.
How did the fire start?
Started by, we never really knew exactly what happened because most of the wiring in the area where the fire did start, which was below Gus Grissom's couch on the left side, was burned up. But almost certainly there was a bare wire there, and almost certainly there was a spark, and that's all it took. If you take a piece of aluminum and put it at 16 pounds per square inch of oxygen, which is about 5 times the amount of oxygen I'm breathing right here, and there's no other gas there but oxygen. If you take a piece of aluminum and put a flame to it, the aluminum will immediately burn. Some of the things in the spacecraft that under that kind of oxygen, pure oxygen at that pressure, literally exploded. And some of them put off toxic gas.
Chris Kraft's memoir of his decades as flight director at NASA's Mission Control is Flight. We'll continue our conversation in the second half of our show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with former NASA flight director Chris Kraft. Also kidnapped, we talk with humanitarian aid worker Kenneth Gluck, who was abducted in Chechnya and held for 26 days. He still doesn't know who his captors were or why he was set free.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's continue our interview with NASA's first flight director, Chris Kraft. He helped design the space program from the ground up, directed NASA's first rocket launches, and helped create mission control. He was the director for all of the Mercury missions, some of the Gemini flights, and oversaw operations during the Apollo missions. When we left off, we were talking about the 1967 fire that killed three astronauts, Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee, during a test exercise for the first Apollo mission. Now, you write that that fire was the reason that future Apollo missions were a success, that you owe it to that tragedy. How so?
I think that the whole team of government and industry were running as fast as they could to get to the moon. And I think as a result, they were ignoring lessons learned from space flights that had taken place previously. They were making what they considered to be considered judgments. And remember, anything is a compromise when you make engineering machines from engineering design. And so they were running so fast, and they thought that that goal was so important that they did things which were less than the best. And under their judgment, that was acceptable. After the fire, it was totally unacceptable. And as a result, the pause that we had to take to prove what happened, to understand what happened, to fix that environment so it wasn't there anymore, and to make modifications to the spacecraft in many, many critical areas. We were able to do that in the hiatus that took place after that. And without those modifications, we would have been a long time getting there, because I think we would have experienced a heck of a lot more failures and probably killed more people in space. As a result, that's the reason I think it was, unfortunately, the catalyst that made it happen properly. And by the way, you certainly didn't have any trouble getting people's attention after that.
I'm talking with Chris Kraft. He was NASA's first flight director, and perhaps one of NASA's best known personalities in the early days of the space program. He has a new memoir, Flight: My Life in Mission Control. Getting to the moon, there were a number of concepts on how to do it. Looking back now on the one you eventually settled on, does it seem ludicrous, the whole lunar module idea? Or you look back and think, what the hell were we thinking?
No, on the contrary. I think that very rapidly I came to the conclusion that that was the only way to do it. If you go look at the Saturn V rocket today, lying on its side like it is at the Johnson Space Center here in Houston, that thing is 300 feet long, and you look at the small capsule up on top where the three men flew, and they're 300 feet above ground level. I'd like to take a test, a airline pilot from a 747 and put him on top of that and say, now land that vertically on the Earth. What kind of answer do you think you'd get? You'd say that you've lost your mind. So I think that was immediately to my idea was talking at a bug, a small thing that looked like the size of a small helicopter, and landing that on the moon sounded to me like a heck of a lot better problem to deal with than trying to land a Saturn V on the moon.
It's interesting, getting back to the lunar landing, how you describe the landing, that it's also not at all like it is in the movies, and that it was hair-raising for you to watch it in Mission Control. What do we not know about it?
Well, let me explain that in several different ways. If you're a airplane pilot today landing at a normal airport, As you make the approach, you see a tree, you see a house, you see a road, you see a human being, and you know how big they are, right? That means that you have some idea and perspective of where you're going and how fast you're getting there. Now put yourself on the moon. It's full of boulders, it's full of craters, and you have the slightest idea how big they are. You don't know whether that crater, as you approach, is 3 feet in diameter or 300 feet in diameter. You don't know whether that rock you're looking at is 10 feet high or 100 feet high. You do when you get there, but as you make your approach, you have nothing as a reference. So landing on the moon the first time, even the second time or third time, has still got that problem. Now, one thing you had going for you was shadows. Okay? So that was the reason we had a launch window, was to make sure that the sun angle was between about 7 and 12 degrees, because that at least, as you approach the moon, you could see these shadows of a big rock or a crater or the rim of a crater. So that did help a lot. But even so, until you were very close, you couldn't tell how big things were. So your ability to have a reference was very poor.
Now, evidently, there was some question whether there would be a television camera on for the lunar landing. How close did you come to not televising it?
Well, as long as I was there, not very close. I know that sounds funny, but let me go back and be a little more realistic. When we were designing the lunar module, every ounce that we put on that spacecraft was important to us, because we couldn't afford to have this thing overweight, because the heavier it got, the more fuel it took and the less margin we had. So we were battling and battling every day to reduce the weight. We made the landing gears thinner. We made the wires so thin it would was hard to work with. We made the hatch thin. We made no seats in there for them to sit down on, no place for them to hang a hammock, hardly, if they were going to sleep in there, et cetera, et cetera. Every piece of paper we put on there had to go through a configuration control board because it weighed something. So in that context, the bosses of the design said, are we going to take a television camera? Because the camera and the transmission equipment is probably going to cost us 10 to 15 pounds. And 10 to 15 pounds was a heck of a lot of weight at that point in time. Now, the other side of that coin is, you mean to tell me that you're going to go land men on the moon for the first time and you're not going to be able to see it happen? You mean to tell me that all these people in this United States who paid their money, we've been telling them about this for the last 8, 9 years, and you're going to tell them you don't have a television camera on board? You got to be kidding me.
So that was the case you made.
That's the case I made. And besides that, I want to see it happen.
You write that you envied the astronauts, that after so many years planning to get a man on the moon, did you wish you weren't staying behind on the ground?
Be perfectly honest, No. I never wanted to go.
Why not?
Because I was on every flight. Vicariously, I was on every flight. They only got to fly once. I got to fly every time they went.
Do you think you could do it? Sit there 43 stories up on top of all that explosive material?
Not without being anesthetized.
Knowing what you know.
You got that right. I mean, let me tell you, if you don't think that lighting up millions of pounds of thrust, burning millions of pounds of propellant every few seconds is dangerous, you don't understand the problem. And that's true today when they fly the space shuttle like it was when we flew Alan Shepard on the Redstone rocket.
Chris Kraft, I'd like to thank you very much for joining me on Fresh Air.
Real pleasure.
Chris Kraft is the former director of NASA's Lyndon B. Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas. His new memoir is Flight, My Life in Mission Control. Coming up, Kidnapped in Chechnya. We talk with humanitarian aid worker Kenneth Gluck. This is Fresh Air. As a humanitarian aid worker, Kenneth Gluck has traveled in many countries devastated by war, Tajikistan, the Sudan, Liberia, and Afghanistan, but he never experienced direct personal danger before Chechnya. On January 9th, while working on a project for Doctors Without Borders in a suburb of Grozny, Gluck was kidnapped at gunpoint and detained for 26 days. 11 of those days he spent in a tiny cellar storage area. The identity of his captors is still unknown. Doctors Without Borders has suspended aid to Chechnya since Gluck's detention, but report they plan to resume their project soon. When I spoke with Kenneth Gluck last week, I asked him how the kidnapping went down on January 9th.
Well, that day we were in the Stariatagi Hospital. Stariatagi is a town in central Chechnya, about 20 kilometers south of Grozny. And it's a place where we've done a lot of work, so I know the people there very well. We were actually finished for the day. We were leaving the hospital in the early afternoon so that we could get back to our base in Ingushetia by nightfall. And we were in a four-car convoy when a car cut us off. Four men with Kalashnikovs, masks, jumped out and surrounded my car and pulled me out. It was all over very quickly. Unfortunately, we were having kind of an animated discussion in the car when it happened, so I didn't even catch the first 15 seconds or so of the attack, and by then it was really over.
I think you got injured. You got hit in the back of the head. How did that happen?
That was actually after they pulled me out of the car. They were dragging me to their car, and they were continuing to fire, and I tried to look back to see what was happening with the people in the convoy. Some of them were very close friends of mine. And they thought I was resisting, so they hit me once over the back of the head with a rifle butt, which, if I had any doubts, convinced me not to resist any further.
They took you into a house, into a cellar of a house. What were your basic conditions like?
Well, we got to the house where I would spend the rest of the 25 days, the very first night, and they put me in a cellar. It's a root cellar. Pretty much most houses in Chechnya or in southern Russia have these things. It's used for storing potatoes and onions and cabbage for the winter. This one was about 40 inches high, so you could just barely sit up. And there was a mattress, some blankets, along with the potatoes and onions and garlic, carrots, and cabbage that most people store.
Is that what you ate?
No, they would bring me out of the basement three times a day to feed me in the beginning, and the food was uninteresting, but sufficient.
You spent 11 days in that cellar. Did you have anything with you to do or to read?
Well, I was fortunate in that I was able to take my bag with me when I was kidnapped. So I had a long book with me in the basement, which I spent most of my time doing. It was on the second or the third day when the guards gave me a kerosene lamp so that I could read.
What was the book?
The book is A History of the Arab Peoples by Albert Hourani, which I read several times.
You were talking to your guards. What kind of information did they give you about why you were being held captive?
They never really gave me any information about why, but like I said, around the second week, their attitude towards me started to improve. At a certain point, it was really one guard I was mostly dealing with. he was very apologetic. He, at one point, he said he's ashamed to stand in front of me, and he realizes what they did was impermissible. We don't know. I don't know why this happened. This is around the same time that they gave me a radio to listen to, which was nice. But we think that the people we've been working with, the people in the hospitals and clinics, they were getting in touch with everybody they could to say that this is something this is intolerable, to tell people about the kind of assistance we had been providing over the last year, and in a way to plead my case. It's one of the nice things about doctors and nurses is that everybody gets sick, so they know people on all sides of the conflict, and they have generally treated somebody's mother, somebody's cousin from any part of society. So they were in touch with people from all around the conflict.
After 11 days in the cellar, they let you come up to the upstairs of the house and live there. You listened to the radio. Did you hear reports of your capture?
Well, they brought me, being moved out of the cellar into a room in the house was a gradual thing. They gradually let me stay more and more upstairs until they let me sleep there. I heard lots of reports about myself. I didn't get the radio until probably, again, 10 or 11 days into the kidnapping. So I think there had been a decline in the news coverage, but sure, there were still things on on BBC, on RFI. There was no NPR in that part of the world.
What happened when they finally let you go? Well,
from the very beginning, really, from the first day of the kidnapping, I had been telling them, just let me go to any hospital. All of the hospitals know us. We trust all of the hospitals. Said, either drop me off at a hospital or drop me off at the house of a head doctor. And in the end, that's what they did. I was taken out. This is the evening of February 3rd. And they took me out at 9 or 10 o'clock at night. Again, drove me about an hour in two different cars. And eventually they stopped in a place, and they did seem to be very apologetic. They apologized many times, saying that this had been a mistake. And when I was still very nervous. I still hadn't really believed that they were going to release me. Until they started returning all of my documents. So they returned my my Doctors Without Borders ID card, my driver's license. They returned the military passes that we had received from the Russians. And they returned $700 in cash, which was maybe one of the more shocking pieces that had been in my pocket when I was kidnapped. The only thing they didn't return was a watch, and they said that, "We're sorry, we can't find your watch." I didn't really mind. It cost about $7, and I told them not to worry about it. And after that, they took me out of the car. I still didn't know where I was because I was still blindfolded, and they pushed me through the gate of a house. And it turns out that this was a house of a doctor who I was very friendly with. I had stayed in his house in the past, and he had already come out, hearing that there were people in front of his house, and he said to me, first in Chechen, which I didn't understand, and then in Russian, "Who are you?" Since I had a mask over my face, and I was too stunned to really answer. I didn't know what to answer in any case. And he actually reached over and lifted up the mask, and then I realized it was an old friend of mine.
There's widespread speculation that it was Russian forces that arranged for your detention, and an obvious motivation would be to encourage humanitarian groups to pull out of Chechnya. That this was a faked kidnapping, and it was a good way to shut down the whole humanitarian mission. Did you buy that? Do you buy that scenario?
We don't know. Unfortunately, because of it sounds silly, but the kidnappers never introduced themselves. They never said who they are, and if they did, I wouldn't necessarily have believed them. We still don't know who organized the kidnapping or why. We do know that there would be no reason for either side in this conflict to have kidnapped us. They both knew exactly what we were up to. We always try to work very openly. Any Chechen hospital could have told them exactly what we're doing, and we always traveled well-marked. They knew where we were going, and both sides knew about us because of our work in the past and because of our reputation. The Russians certainly knew us because we do a lot of work in Russia outside of Chechnya. They're a There are very large tuberculosis control projects in Siberia that are done very closely with the Russian government. There are AIDS control programs and programs providing health care for homeless people in Moscow and St. Petersburg. It's not as if we're an unknown quantity to the Russian government or to the rebels.
I'm talking with Kenneth Gluck. He's a humanitarian aid worker for Doctors Without Borders. He was abducted in Chechnya on January 9th, spent 26 days in captivity. We'll talk more after break. This is Fresh Air. Back with humanitarian aid worker Kenneth Gluck. While working for Doctors Without Borders in Chechnya in January, he was kidnapped and held for 26 days. His captors have never been identified. Could you talk more about the humanitarian situation in Chechnya? You were working in hospitals. What kind of supplies did they have? What were they like?
Well, the hospitals in Chechnya, many of them have been devastated by the bombing, particularly the hospitals in Grozny, in some of the more mountainous areas as well. The Vidino Hospital, for example, it really had 7 of its 10 wards were completely flattened. In the pediatric hospital number 2 in Grozny, I think there's only one wall left standing. A place like that is not functioning anymore. The pediatric hospital number 2 has had to move and just take over an abandoned building, which they're now gradually repairing, putting in heat, and starting to work. The doctors in places like this have been working sometimes for long periods of time with no medical inputs. So if you're brought in wounded into a Chechen hospital, very often the first thing they'll tell the relatives who bring in a wounded person is, these are the things you have to find. Go find them and we'll start operating. Sometimes the doctors will have a small private stash of their own for emergency cases, but unfortunately they're really not having the equipment they need.
What kind of care are the doctors and also you aid workers able to administer in Chechnya in the hospitals under such challenging conditions?
Well, it's actually a phenomenon, but in some of these half-destroyed hospitals, they're doing very sophisticated surgery. They do it with old half-destroyed equipment that they've managed to fix. A lot of doctors hid their instruments during the bombing, including some of them buried them. I was in one place. It's literally a bomb shelter where they had essentially an underground operating theater going on for months. These are some of the most experienced war surgeons around. They've dealt with so much war trauma over the last 5 or 6 years that they've developed ways of operating in these conditions. So there's really I think that's one of the things that shocked our Doctors Without Borders doctors who came in, is to what extent that they had managed to keep sophisticated healthcare going in horrible circumstances.
Do you feel any lasting residue from your experience? Any, I don't know, dreams, or when you have a quiet moment, does your mind go back to what you experienced?
I certainly spent a lot of time thinking about mistakes that I made, that my team made, which allowed us to get kidnapped. You know, most of what sticks in my mind is really the people who did all of these things to get me out, and who really suffered that period. Probably, I think, more than I did. There's one friend of mine, also a Chechen doctor, who I saw the night I finally got back to the Doctors Without Borders office in Ingushetia. And he really looked like he had aged 20 years just in that 1 month. And, I felt that I was feeling much better than he was during that period.
In your career as an aid worker, have you suffered burnout?
These are situations where you need a break from. But you always come back to, you're always in a way motivated by the people you work with. I'm on vacation now. They said, okay, you've had a rough time. Go and take a month in New York. The Chechen doctors I'm working with, they can't leave. That's their country. And they get up every day and go to work in conditions that are much more difficult than mine. They're much more at risk by what's going on there. So, and this is not only true of Chechnya. I remember this from Sudan. I remember this from Tajikistan. I remember this from Liberia. The people you're working with, they have no vacation from their country. That crisis, that suffering, is theirs day in and day out. And they end up inspiring you. Watching suffering does burn a person out, but watching people cope with suffering also inspires us. And I think that most of the people I work with, most of the people in Doctors Without Borders, would say that the inspiration far outweighs the tendency towards burnout. You really watch people rise, rise to the occasion, and it's a real honor to work in the presence of that.
Kenneth Gluck, I want to thank you very much for talking with me today on Fresh Air.
Okay, thank you very much.
Kenneth Gluck works for the humanitarian aid organization Doctors Without Borders. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Patty Leswing and Megan Howell. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperback Division, publisher of Get Happy, The Life of Judy Garland by Gerald Clark. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The film You Can Count on Me has been nominated for Academy Awards for Best Original Screenplay and Best Actress. On the next Fresh Air, we meet Kenneth Lonergan, who wrote and directed the film. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.